Welcome back to part two of episode 36. In part one, we heard from actress, comedian and presenter Samantha Rank, caught up with Richard Robinson from eConsultancy and discussed his once and only experience of discrimination, which has pushed him to advocate for equality and diversity within the industry, and from a number of people attending the event, what they were looking forward to and what they've taken away so far. In part two, we're covering what unfolded in the afternoon. We experienced a huge fishbowl with the entire room, approximately 300 people. I had a mentoring session with the wonderful Natalie Graham from Uncommon, and Renee caught up with Rosa Rolo from Major Players and brand consultant Abby Comber. Today was epic. I've learnt so much and I feel really energised. The best moments for me were definitely my mentoring session with Natalie, which you can listen to in full. I also really loved hearing the panel discussion on what's keeping CMOs up at night. Abby Comber was particularly engaging, and I thought from the perspective of working in an agency, it was really great to hear some thoughts from the client side.
So could you introduce yourself for me and tell me what your name is and what your job role is?
So my name is Blaise Grimes. I'm Chief Services Officer at The Social Element, a social media agency.
What about your takeaways at the end of the day?
I think it's ideas of, you know, how we can provide our clients with the representative view of all segments of society, not an interpreted and filtered view from one segment.
Can you introduce yourself to me and tell me about your job role?
Yes, so I'm Elise Santangelo. I'm a design director at Design Studio.
And what are you looking forward to this afternoon?
Definitely the talk about imposter syndrome, something I suffer from a lot. But yeah, I think they all should be brilliant.
Mary is the founder and chief creative agency of Portis, where Creative Equals are also based in Women. One of many, many, many examples of Mary not only working like a woman, but supporting other women. And she's the living definition of the magic that can happen when you bring your whole self to work and work like a woman. So in Work Like a Woman, which is a fabulous, fabulous read, you give so many examples again and again of trusting the value of your intuition and the value of making creatively radical decisions. And at Harvey Nichols, you made waves by creating a platform for emerging designers, so the very definition of shine theory. And it's a tricky time for retail at the moment. I mean, do you think the industry needs to put the creativity back into the British high street, and how do we do that as creative people?
The future of the high street will not be anywhere near as much bricks and mortar as retail. We have to understand that. The world's moved on. We are living in a completely different time. We consume differently. What the internet has done has been greater than the Industrial Revolution. So we've moved into a new era. When you go into a new era, or you know instinctively and you're connected creatively, you kind of see it coming. One of my favourite people is Lee Edelcourt, who's a trained forecaster. If you get a chance to read her stuff, she is an extraordinary woman. So all the brands globally go to her. And she talks about instinct all the time. And she said, instinct, we've had it suppressed for so many years in business because it does not back up by data. Well, that's what the numbers say. And you go, well, it's just my feeling. Sounds really naff, right? But actually, it is the most powerful thing we all have. So what we didn't have in some of the retailers, like the House of Frasers, like half the Muppets that lost on the business, was they didn't see and understand and instinctively know what the future was going to be, so they didn't create a new business model. Marks and Spencer's still turning out the same old stuff that they turned out 10 years. Shop floor, the food business next to it, no particular service, women wearing fleeces coming out of the food department serving on the fashion. They look like airport hangers. Meanwhile, in drives Zara, in drives H&M, they redefine what fast fashion is. It's about delivery, it's about taking the codes of luxury. You look at Zara windows like Chanel. No service, you don't need the bloody service, it's there. And what is the role of Marks and Spencer? And I don't think any bloke sitting on the board, and they're all men, they've got women buyers. They all have the women buyers, but they never quite make it to the board. I remember going in for meetings, painting after painting after painting of the chairman where was the vision? Where was the vision of what this could be? And here's the thing. When we look at the shift that's happened in the way that we're living, where people, you know, probably about 60% will be working from homes or spaces, why didn't Marks and Spencer or House of Fraser go, do you know what? I'm going to make the first floor a working space for small entrepreneurs. I'm going to put a gym next to it because they'll probably want to work out. We see that that's a growth area. We'll put well-being into it. I'll put street food in because they'll all need eating during the day. I'll diminish the retail mix because I don't need as much of it. And you start to have a new business model. They didn't do it. And then the high street's dead. The high street's not dead. The Muppets are in these businesses that should be dead. And that's what I'm doing.
Industries. There's so many brilliant creative women in this room. What do you think is the opportunity there for women to come in and drive a new cultural narrative?
That's the opposite. It's a new cultural narrative. It's not trying to be what the old dinosaurs were. I was in the dinosaur land, and you look back and you go, what was that? And this is the same with the retail businesses. It's alpha culture. So 80% of what we know, and we can all fanny around the numbers, but 80% of most buying decisions are made by women. That's it. Whether it's their children, whether it's their friends, whether it's that birthday present to their nephew, whether it's their best friend, whether it's their old man's pants, don't want to go there, or even on the car that they choose, the woman has major influence. We work with Mercedes for years, we have incredible insights on this. So here's the thing, we're all in those nice roles where we can influence the fashion. If you went into the buying department of Marks and Spencer's, Automotive, they're all women buyers. They just don't make it important. So you realise, actually, what's wrong here is that the culture and the alpha codes of top-tier management has been created historically by men for men. And it's only in the past 50 years that we've really made inroads into business. Now, I'm looking around here, and you're all terribly young. You know, and you're all going, what's she on about? Watch this space. When you get to my age, when you get to 30s and 40s and you have children, what were we just discussing? You went to someone and said, can I have, I want to just lessen my hours by three, my week by 3 hours, and they said no. Really insightful people they are, understanding this, isn't it? That you can work from home, and that if they commit to you and they look after you, you will symbiotically create that relationship back with them. We need, as women, and men who don't want to work like the old dinosaur way, create the new codes of what culture is and what true diversity means and why we think it's right for business. So I always put the numbers in so the old cynics can look at that as well. It is commercial. But we need to show the golden key that says that is no longer relevant. This is the future. And here's the thing. You guys should be driving it, and you can do that from the bottom. You can come together and find your own tribes and influence making change. Because your conversation with your boss would have been you on a one-to-one, and then her toddling up to the board, and they're all going, no. If you had gone together, I'm not saying this is just, but a group of you saying, this is not working for us as a company, and there's power in that, they have to start to listen. And we started to see this gap. The gaps come from the Me Too movement, the gender pay gap movement, and as Lee Evercourt calls it, the time of the goddess. It's coming. It's coming. And the thing is, we need to drive door. The door's open, we need to kick the fucking hinges off it and drive in and go, no more. This is the way we want to work. And women work differently from men, and we work very differently from alpha culture. And we need to knock that on the head.
Start by introducing yourself and telling me about your job role.
Hi, I'm Candice Kuss. I am the Director of Social Media for Hill & Knowlton Strategies.
Who are you looking forward to hearing speak today most before you got here?
Well, Mary Porter's obviously is an icon.
And what was it about Mary's talk that you liked the most?
I like that she has, you know, she's got tremendous experience and is very much a straight talker. So she'll say what she thinks. She has the success to back it up. She's gone through lots of different avenues in her career, you know, and different aspects. So it's not just words. She has backed it up with her deeds.
With a number of years industry experience, previously working for agencies such as Grey and Mother, Natalie Graham went on to found Uncommon, a creative studio building brands that people in the real world actually wish existed, either by working with clients or by creating brands themselves. She's also a She Says, Who's Your Mama mentor, and like many other incredible women today, have offered to provide some mentoring at the event during the lunch break. Ursi, my co-host for the day, is an assistant producer looking to progress her career and move forward into a producer role, and has organised a session with Natalie for the podcast.
So, as Renee said, I'm currently an assistant producer working in branded content and kind of looking to progress my career. Being promoted to a producer level would mean taking on more of a leadership role. Do you have any advice on managing people?
This is always a hard one, because I think when people become managers, the assumption is that they've learned how to become a manager beforehand, and the reality is you've learned a craft skill and you've done that exceptionally well, which is always the great, I think that's the best way to be promoted, which is to become brilliant at something so that you are a shining star for the people beneath you to be inspired by. But I think the most important thing then is, and I'm not suggesting you would be, but to become too big for your boots and see that this is a power trip. It's not about you when you're managing people, it's about them. Mm. It's about helping make sure that that whole team can get the most out of your support. And if you encourage them to be their best, it will make your life an awful lot easier as a manager. And the best way to do that is to be human. So not see it as a team that needs to be corralled and contained, although sometimes that will happen, but also just being really candid. Mm. So the level of candor you can build with a team, I think, allows them to be honest about where they're nervous, where their strengths and weaknesses are, and for them to feel that there is a sense of trust. Mm. So that they won't ideally let you down, and if they do, you can be very candid back as to why that might have happened. So I think that would be my biggest advice, would be as candid and human as possible in that relationship and not see it as something that you need to structure.
That is great advice. I think one of the things that I'm panicking about most when it comes to thinking about managing people is thinking about that time kind of taking over within my role and then not having as much time for the work that I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I guess in my mind, yeah, having obviously not stepped into this role, I'm just struggling with that.
It will take time.
Yeah.
In both senses of the word. It will take you time to find time for that in your role, and it will take time from your day. Mm. The best managers that I've observed and I've worked for are the ones that are always available. Mm. But there are ways of making sure you have time for that in your day rather than being bombarded by lots of people coming and tapping you on the shoulder just at that moment where you've broken concentration. So being able to have regular slots with people, making sure that they feel that you're accessible, mm. but accessible on your terms, is really, really important to make sure you can allow yourself to be as available to them as possible, but equally set some ground rules about when and how to do that. So regular check-ins with people, if they know they've got a check-in coming in with you, they'll prepare for that better and they'll gather things up, unless it's really urgent, and then they'll grab you and you'll be glad that they did.
Yeah, that's true. So that's really good advice. Thank you. My second question is kind of around progression. I think at times I still feel kind of uncharacteristically uncomfortable when it comes to conversations around promotions and pay rises. I was wondering if you had any advice when it comes to kind of negotiating your progression.
I do. I've been shocking about this over the past. I was actually talking
really
to someone
scary.
Else here today. Well, I think I always had that good girl attitude of expecting that if I made myself invaluable and I worked really hard and I worked really long hours, that people would see my worth. And I think that fortunately hasn't held me back, but I don't know anything other than what I've been paid and the way I've been progressing. But I did move around agencies an awful lot, which I think in a way allows you to test your market worth, and you do have a headhunter at that point to help you. And I'm not by any means suggesting that that's the way to do it. I guess I inadvertently ended up doing that, and therefore getting pay rises at certain points. My suggestion would be that try and understand your worth within that company, how integral you are and how culturally important you are to that company, but also understanding how the business makes money. Know whether you are, this horrible word, recoverable. So is the work that you spend, and not hours necessarily, but is the work that you're doing of value to a client, and is a client paying for it? And if they are, do you know what rate you're being charged out at? Do you know what's in those fees? And that should be fairly transparent in a company to try and understand that, because quite frankly, particularly as a producer, you'll be wanting to be really financially very savvy and understanding what your profit margin is on certain jobs. So it's in the company's interest as well to make sure that you're kind of understanding that. That bit can be uncomfortable, at least it's not related to you. And I think understanding how a business makes money, then you can work out, actually, you can make it really easy for a company to pay you more, because if you are genuinely valuable and you are doing lots of work that is of value, literally clients are paying for it, then there is more money available
to be had.
To be had, and you are obviously invaluable to the company. And I think that just allows you to walk into those conversations with a lot more in your armoury as to how you're going to approach that chat.
Yep.
And obviously there'll be other things you don't know about, how a company is operating and what else is going on, but at least you can have that from a position of strength and knowledge. And it isn't a case of please could I have a pay rise. You can actually ask for a number and feel kind of confident what might be acceptable and what your market rate might be. And also have candid chats with headhunters. Doesn't mean to say you want to move. That's not disingenuous to regularly be testing that. You don't have to be looking to move to do that. That can actually just give you a bit more of a sense.
Just a benchmark. Yeah, that's exactly. A good idea. I hadn't thought about that. I think for me, within that conversation, it's kind of taking the emotion out of it as well. I always feel like, especially when it comes to speaking with line managers and that kind of thing, that there's always a lot of emotion in the room that doesn't need to be there, that shouldn't be there.
I always felt that too.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably a sign of the passion that you feel. And that's a good thing. But I think it shouldn't be an emotion-led conversation. It doesn't need to be an emotion-led conversation. And weirdly, understanding those numbers will mean that you can still be passionate about things and you still should know your worth emotionally in the company, but it will actually give you some kind of harder facts, if you like, that will allow you to have that conversation on a more professional basis.
Thank you. That is really good advice. I wondered if you had any advice on a change of career path. Not necessarily for right now, but I feel at some point in my life I'd like to gain some experience as a producer on documentaries. And currently all of my experience is in kind of branded content or online content creation. How would I go about making that transition or meeting the right people or whatever it is?
Well, there are a number of different ways to do it. I think by the sounds of it, that's a kind of lateral move, so it's at least related. And at least with documentaries, actually, they're the sorts of things I've done one before. Mine took about 3 years to make. So what I would say is they can take a lot longer. Mm. And so if you're thinking about this in the future, start cooking it up now. Mm. I think the network around those documentaries in particular is quite nice to tap into. There's a lot of film festivals. There's a lot of trying to understand the lay of the land there. So I definitely would just make sure you're swimming around in that, just like you are in this industry. There are a lot of people very, very keen to offer their point of view and offer mentoring. And I think don't be afraid to reach out to people you respect. Mm. But if you are going to do that, reach out with a particular question. And then at least people will, you're giving them a chance to give you that kind of bit of advice, but not necessarily be too burdensome on their time, I think, to start with.
Yeah.
And then I think there is a bit of try before you buy. Like, trying to do it, obviously, you're clearly busy, you're clearly pushing for promotion anyway, but having a side hustle can actually allow you to bring those skills to bear.
That's true.
At work. I can't imagine, certainly if I was your employer, that would be incredible if you were doing that as well. I'd think you would be even more invaluable because, goodness, doing it with no client budget, and trying to make that happen, that's ballsy and brilliant. And I think if you can find some like-minded people to do that with, even if it's a small subject, I think try and have a go, I would. And I know that's easier said than done, having done one myself. And then I guess the other bit is go off and make the tea. So yeah. when I wasn't allowed to work in the industry for a year before starting Uncommon, I went and I offered to make the tea and intern at lots of different companies. Mm. So I went into feature film production companies, gaming, VCs, tech startups. You can be valuable even if you know nothing,
yeah.
but you have to be prepared to be right at the bottom and observing.
Yeah.
And for me, that was an amazing opportunity to really understand how all of it worked and the machinations and what the parallels were with my current, you know, hopeful job, and then also why it was different. And I think you'll be able to do that if you just went in and made the tea for a bit. Maybe, you know, an extra week's holiday or an unpaid leave holiday from true. Work to be able to do that. I think that sort of thing would be a real chance for you to see, because you may not want to do it as a career.
It's
might
true.
Always want to be something that you do as a side hustle.
I think I'll kick myself if I never try, so kind of have to give it a go.
Well, and then there's a certain point where you think, well, you just got to jump in.
Yeah, it's true.
But I would give it a go a little bit beforehand, if you can, on a small project, and I would talk to a bunch of people about the realities of the industry and see how the kind of cycles work at the film shows and what have you. And
cool.
I'm sure you know all about it.
Yeah, I do know a little bit, but yeah, it's great to hear you talk about it. Thank cool. you.
So, could you introduce yourself to me and tell me about your job role?
My name's Lisa Berenson. I am a creative lead at a digital agency called Phantom. We work mostly with Google. I also do other creative projects. I'm a writer and I play music.
What was your favourite thing about today?
I think maybe the mentorship, sitting around and getting actually talking to women who are kind of a step ahead of you, either in your field or a similar field, but actually getting to like sit down and have a more one-on-one chat. I think the talks are always really inspiring, but they can be a little bit intimidating. So kind of it made it feel a little bit more kind of personal, and you kind of realize that they're kind of just a little bit more like you. Liz had some really nice ideas for how to manage self-doubt and nerves around presenting. So little things like she said, holding your left thumb, which was really, it was like a simple thing, but as a comfort, yeah. So she does it when she needs to calm down, because it's something that children do when they suck their thumb, and that there's a kind of calming effect and no one knows you're doing it. So thank you, Liz, for that. That was a really nice tip. I'll definitely be doing that.
Rosa Rollo is commercial director at agency Major Players. In her role, she works closely with the MD and the board to ensure the highest levels of service and delivery to clients. Rosa was part of the section today that was focusing on the theme, Leading Your Way. So Rosa, you discussed giving diversity context. Can you give us an overview of what was presented?
Yeah, absolutely. So we do an annual salary survey every year, which goes out to about 3,500 participants, which looks at benchmarking of salaries. But what it also does is gives us some really key insights as to what's happening in each of the different markets that we cover. And specifically, we pulled out some themes around the gender pay gap, around ageism in the industry, and around jobs filled by people from a BAME background. Firstly, we looked at the gender pay gap. We launched an initiative last year called Earn Your Worth, which essentially is around not asking people to disclose their current salary, or not asking them the question, what are you currently on? And starting to ask the question, what are you looking for? The reason that we did this is we found that there was a gender pay gap, but it was starting at a really early stage in people's careers. So junior designer, junior copywriter, male and female were being paid 23% difference.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
No, seriously.
Yeah, so from such an early stage, that gender pay gap is there. And then what happens is, as line managers, as recruiters, as people, you go, okay, what are you earning? Okay, I'm going to increase you by X amount, because the thought of increasing somebody by more than that amount feels uncomfortable as human beings, weirdly. And so what happens is we continuously perpetuate that gap, because we're saying, okay, male, you're on 25, we'll put you up to 30. Female, you're on 22, we'll put you up to 25. And then that gap widens further up the scale. So just by taking that bias away of what are they currently earning and focusing on what they're on begins to take that away. The gender pay gap's gone up this year. It's actually 27%. So it's not working. So basically, when I was on stage today, I was just pleading with people to join the initiative. We've not done it as a commercial venture, we've done it as something that's actually going to begin to affect the industry. And there's lots more things to do about the gender pay gap, but that's just one thing that's quite simple that everybody can do straight away. Mm. So that was the gender pay gap stats. We then looked at ageism, which is just horrifying. 2% of people over the age of 55 filled in our survey. And we know there's a massive issue. I regularly have candidates who say, oh, I might be too old. which is just really upsetting. And the what I was saying on stage is we don't have a solution right now, but I was calling it out and I was saying that there is an issue. You know, I spoke to some candidates about it and said one of the main themes is they didn't feel cool enough. Who defines what cool is? Cool to who? You know, I think what I always has startled me about the advertising world is they're selling to the whole of the consumer base, yet they seem to only represent a tiny bit of our consumer base. I read some stats about the fact that older people have a spending power of X amount now. Why are we not marketing to them? And surely we need the insight of those people in the room. And then finally, we looked at people from a BAME background. It's really interesting. I stole or borrowed the words from Candice Carty-Williams. I don't know if you've come across her. She's written this amazing book called Queenie, which I'm listening to at the moment. But she talks about BAME people not being a minority, but having been minoritised. And that's definitely the case when it comes to the creative industries. So only 10.9% of jobs are filled by people by a BAME background, as opposed to 40% of the London population. So they were the stats aspect of it.
Yeah.
And then we moved on to how do we change it? And major players have launched a piece of software which essentially allows every single candidate to fill in a questionnaire that looks at the context of where they've come from and whether they've faced adversity, but also the academic performance of that person in the right. Because what I was saying is, if the hiring criteria is set by white middle-class people who continue to look at good academic grades, good universities, strong social skills from their perspective, and don't flex the criteria, then we're never going to change the barriers to encompass. And what we were looking at is particularly those from a lower socioeconomic background tend to capture people from a BAME background. Also, though, if we look at adversity that people have overcome, so if we look at the fact that you're a parent returning to work, that you've been a carer, whether that's for your parents, whether that's for a sibling, and you're returning to work, you've overcome some adversity to get there. And essentially, this piece of software gives us context for when people are applying that we can then utilise within the interview process.
Mm-hmm. You also talked about your background and the way you've experienced and how then your kind of upbringing. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
I suppose standing up in front of a room of 400 brilliant people as a young woman, the imposter syndrome is there. And also from someone who on the surface is a white middle class woman who has a lot of confidence, even though I was crapping myself. And so I was thinking actually about how do I, and I think one of the things about recruitment is the fact that I get to meet lots of different people. And I was thinking actually what is it that drives that? And then I was thinking about the fact that actually I've always felt very different. My little sister's gay. And I remember when she first came out, I was so sad about it, not for the fact that she was gay, I was absolutely fine with that, but for how society might treat her around the fact that she had to declare her sexual preference. My mum's in a wheelchair. She had a brain hemorrhage when I was 4, so I've grown up my entire life with a mum in a wheelchair who has brain damage. And I went to an inner city school in Bradford whose community was 70% Pakistani. And so those experiences make me who I am, but also enable me to see things away from my white middle class privilege and start to see it from different avenues, I guess, which I think just makes me so grateful, but also so passionate about fighting for those causes. Because whilst I've leveraged my white middle classness to get where I am, could my sister do that? And what if my mum wanted to go back to work? And what about those kids that I went to school with that didn't have the opportunities that I did, who were brilliant in their own right? And so it gives me a passion. I also work with the most brilliant counterpart. My MD is phenomenal, and we call each other yin and yang. And she just has a very different background to me. She left school at 16, no GCSE, single parent, mother who looked after her and her sister, who are both phenomenally talented. And so between us, we've kind of climbed the ranks and we're now running this 100-person recruitment company, and we've got a voice that we can change stuff. And so we're doing it, and that's brilliant.
And we need you.
It's so great. I'm so proud of what we do as a business. And it's not just Joe, it's our board. You know, we're 4 females against 3 males, not against, working with them. We've got a really diverse set of people in our business. Yeah. And we need to mirror that. You know, one of our things is we can't just talk the talk, we need to walk the walk. Yeah. So that's kind of where we're at with things. But it's getting agencies and brands to be on that same page. Mm. So when we introduce talent, A, they're going to be receptive to them, but B, they're going to make them feel welcome, because that's on my conscience when I introduce somebody and say, here, here's your next career move. And then they go into that job and they're made to feel miserable. That lies heavy on my heart.
As a recruiter, if someone is thinking about making a change, you know, they don't feel so comfortable where they are and they're looking to make a change, coming to major players and thinking about changing their role or progressing their career, what advice would you give?
I think the first thing I always say to people, and it doesn't have to be coming to major players, you know, they can go and speak to people on their own, but the first thing is, why are they wanting to leave? What are the lists of things? Is it that they're bored of the creative that they're doing, they're not happy with the account? Is it then they're not happy with the management structure? Is it that they're just ready for that next challenge and getting that really clear? Often as recruiters, our first question is, why are you leaving? And we really want to understand what's making them tick to get them to the next place. Thinking about, is it to do with the fact that they want a pay rise, which is often part of the equation? And, you know, often the advice that I give people around negotiating pay rises is look at the job that you did when you started. So when you got your last pay rise, when you joined that company, what was the job spec? And write down everything that you've done and then everything that you've done beyond that. Because essentially, more often than not, you are doing the job and some, and get that written down. So you've got the confidence to say, okay, this is now where I'm at. Talk to your peers, talk to your colleagues, talk to your friends, talk to your boyfriend, girlfriend, mum, and get them to give you that, right, what is it that I'm good at? What is it that I'm not sure of? And then take that either into a room with your boss and ask the conversation, ask the question and say, this is what I'm looking for next. And if they say no, find out why. What's the criteria? What do they need to do? And then ultimately, you've got a choice. There are a lot of companies that just can't afford to pay what the Googles or the Facebooks are paying. And then you've got a choice to decide, is it salary or is it the work? And is it how you feel and how you're made to feel in that business? Equally, you know, if you're looking for new opportunities, think about, is it actually the money or is it the work that you get exposed to? Is it how it makes you feel every day? And take that brief to a recruiter. A good recruiter should then be briefing you on things that you've said you want.
Thank you so much for your time, Rose. It's so lovely
so
catching
welcome.
Up with
it's
you.
It's so lovely to meet you.
You too.
She's also a partner on Valuable 500, which is a global campaign putting disability on the global biz agenda. What she's about to do is what is this incredible thing called a fishbowl. Now, has anyone in the room done one of Gemma's fishbowls before? Okay. So, Gemma usually does these fishbowls with much smaller groups. I was really, really lucky to be part of one of Gemma's fishbowls on neurodiversity. It's an amazing thing to be a part of, so please participate. Also, please bear with her, because it's a bloody big crowd to be doing a fishbowl. And this fishbowl is on a topic that's very close to my heart, which is imposter syndrome. And I'm going to let the incredible Gemma Briggs come up and explain how it's all going to work. Gemma Briggs. I'm sure he wouldn't say it today, but I just have to give a massive shout out to Pip. She is unbelievable. And also to Ali. And it's Ali's bravery that's allowing the fishbowl to be here today. Because, as Pip said earlier, we've done fishbowls all around the world, and we're very proud of them, and they've been cool. But with 50, 60, 70 people, how many have we got here today? 300. Excellent. So, let's see how it goes. But they say, as the brilliant Mum Rose said earlier, it's only through discomfort that you can achieve things and make change. So hopefully that's what we're going to do today. And I have to say, I'm feeling rather brave right now doing this with you all. And I'm really encouraging you all to take
So I'm going to come into the middle of the room because the idea of this is it's interactive. And there's meant to be a pathway, but I can't see a pathway, but I'm going to have to come past you guys. Thank you. Oh, that's so nice. I feel like Jesus now. Amazing. So the rules of the fishbowl. The whole point is there's not a set speakers. Everyone takes part, or whoever, as many people want to take part as possible in the time we've got allotted, which is about half an hour. There's two parts to the fishbowl. The first is that we share some personal experiences. Do that for about 15, 20 minutes. We've got a timer, because we've done a lot of these fishbowls over over the last couple of years, and we found that actually more and more people want to speak, but don't feel they can because of other people maybe speaking for longer or louder or what have you. So we've got a timer which is up to 2 minutes, so we can get as many voices as possible. And I've noticed there hasn't been that many questions in the room today, so I'm really hoping that people take part and get involved, because that's the way that we can start to make some change. So what I wanted to do was tee up a couple of people who are amazing, and then from there, get everyone else to get involved. What we would love, there's going to be roving mics coming around. What we would love is if you stand in the middle here, because that's brilliant. But if you're not up for that, you can be at your table and ideally stand up and share. And then there's a little sound that goes off if we've gone over our 2 minutes to get as many as possible, including me, Vicky, looking at you there to take part. Many people have heard that, you know, imposter syndrome is something that is, you know, only women suffer from. Well, that's absolute bollocks. It's not at all. We all suffer, as I talked about earlier. But women tend to talk about it a little bit more. So I thought it'd be good to get a man first up. And when I was thinking about who to bring, it was something that it's quite a big deal, actually. So who would be up for sharing, but also just a marvellous human being that would want to take part? And that man's Rupert Turnbull, who many of you will know. He has been in publishing for many years. He was part of the founding team for Wired, most recently at Time, a very, very successful human being, and knows everyone how to do a slug on an amazing night out that he might share later with you. But without further ado, Rupert Turnbull, come and share.
So a few days ago, we were talking about this, and I stupidly opened my big mouth and said, oh, I'm really interested in that subject. I've gone back to school and I'm in the kind of middle of doing a master's in coaching. And my dissertation is next year. I've had to decide what I'm going to do. And I'm doing on imposter syndrome. She said, oh, fantastic, you can come along and do this thing. And I'm like, really? No. The reason I've chosen it is because I recognise empathise massively with the symptoms of imposter syndrome, which are basically fear, anxiety, self-doubt. Perfectionism is one of them as well, which I don't suffer from, but the other three I do. I should stop using the word suffer, which I'll come on to in a minute. But those are the sort of the general symptoms, and it's just basically self-doubt. And actually, you know, as Gemma said at the beginning, it's something that is pretty universal, right, other than psychopaths. It's a pretty universal thing, but it's actually, there's the Boffins call it pluralistic ignorance, which basically means we all know about it, but no one ever admits it, and therefore we're ignorant that actually it's walking around, everyone's feeling the same way. So, the thing to do is talk about it. But also, I have a contention, and I'm going to work on throughout my next year, is that actually, potentially, it's a superpower. You know, it's a strength, it's a driver of kind of productive, positive behaviour. But only if kind of recognised, thought through, managed, kind of harnessed, and all those things. If not, if it's kind of left unharnessed, is that a word? Then it becomes very debilitating and be a kind of limiting force. So that's my time's up. So basically, we just need to talk about it. Bravely, we need a lot of brave leaders in the world today. And if we haven't got self-assured people, and it's leaders as well who suffer massively from this as well, but never talk about it, they need to talk about it. They need to get better because they can't make brave decisions if they're not self-confident. Okay, that's it.
Amazing. Thank you.
Thank
you so much, Rupert. So next up, and then it really is open to all of you. But another amazing human being who I have the pleasure of being in my life.
that sounds slightly wrong, we're not together. I'm okay with rumours. Oh dear. Sophie. So Sophie Morgan, Channel 4 TV presenter and a brilliant disability rights activist and, as I said, amazing human being. Here we go. Thanks, Gemma. So, yeah, as Gemma said, I can't swing around because I've now got one hand on a mic, so I'm sorry, I'm going to only be able to talk to you because I can't move my wheelchair. So, to everybody, I'm an artist. I'm a disability rights advocate. I am a broadcast regulator. I'm a disability consultant. I'm a TV presenter, but underneath it all, I am a paraplegic and I'm a wheelchair user. And my career kind of evolved and then now very much revolves around disability. That wasn't really my intention. I had my injury when I was 18 and my life just then obviously took its form and much of what I do now relates to disability. And the way that imposter syndrome has worked out for me, despite all of the success or all of the accomplishments, all of my goals that I've achieved, is that everything I do, this little voice comes into my head and it says, well, that's because you're disabled. So you only got the job because you're disabled. You know, you only got that TV job presenting the Paralympics, or you only spoke at the UN, or you only won that award because you're disabled. Now, inadvertently, what that has done has made me love my disability. So obviously, it might not be true, it might be false, it might be true, we don't know. The imposter syndrome has this ability to get into your mind and play with you, and I don't think that that's a bad thing. So yes, maybe it's true, maybe it's not true, maybe I did get the job because I'm disabled, maybe I didn't, maybe I got it because I'm good, who knows. The reality is, the voice in my head has told me that that's because of my disability, so I love my disability because I love what I do. So my message, I think my learning about the imposter syndrome, and I think speaks to what you were just talking about, is that we all have it, you can't get rid of it, it will taint everything you do, but it doesn't have to be negative. And I think that ultimately, if you can embrace it and not see it as something to overcome, but instead work with and enjoy, it can turn your weaknesses, your disabilities, in inverted commas, into abilities, and you can start to see your adversity as opportunity. So that's it. Thanks.
What was your favourite thing that you saw today?
My favourite bit, which I can't believe I did, but I got up in the fishbowl and, yeah, spoke about imposter syndrome. And that 2 minutes was actually really scary. I felt slightly vomity, but at the same time, it was great to do. And I thought, you know what, now or never. Why am I just sitting here wanting to do something? All I have to do is actually just stand up.
Yeah.
That's fine. And I did it.
Could you start by introducing yourself and telling me about your job role?
Sure. So my name's Liz Nottingham. I'm the Executive EMEA HR Director at RGA.
What was your favourite thing from today?
I loved Mary's talk. I loved the fact she was talking about how we're losing our instinct because everything needs to be backed up with data. I totally understand and appreciate data and insights, of course, but that's also damaging creativity, and listening to intuition, I think, is really, really important. And having the courage, like Mary, to go into those boardrooms and shake up those conversations and speak to those dinosaurs, I think was really, really inspiring for the audience here today.
So can you introduce yourself and tell me about your job role?
My name is Marcella and I'm a creative at Poke.
And from the afternoon, what was your kind of favourite session? A lot of people have been saying that they really enjoyed the fishbowl.
I really enjoyed Liz. I just loved the way that she approached the whole imposter syndrome in a way, and the whole like idea of, you know, understanding the voices that you have in your head and not identifying with them and kind of seeing them from far away and understanding they're just voices and kind of how to deal with them, which I definitely empathize with. So it was really good to hear that I'm not the only one.
Abby Combat is an expert in brand building, marketing, and customer experience development. She has a vast knowledge and experience in marketing, media, customer proposition, design, and delivery. She was with British Airways for 17 years, rising to head of brand, and is now consulting for brands, and she's also looking for her next role. This morning, she was on a panel chaired by Richard Robinson discussing what keeps CMOs up at night. So, Abby, can you give us an overview of what was discussed?
Yes, we were discussing a lot the interface between the creatives in a business and the clients. I was making quite an impassioned point about the fact that as a client, I want to see in person the creative, the person who's going to create this amazing kind of stop you in your street, think about my brand activity. Mm-hmm. It's really important that the structure of organisations doesn't dilute the message of what it is a brand wants and what we're asking a creative person to come up with in copy or in imagery. So I was really pushing for people to meet and collaborate together rather than go through what I often see as more traditional structures of always having the account person for an agency, which is a critical role, but making sure they're not a barrier to making sure the creative flows. And I also made a big plea for the creatives in the audience to understand the consumer of their client. You know, ask for the information, go and meet them, experience their product for them so they really, really can get under the skin of it.
I mean, I really like that you talked about being bolshy.
I think that's just because I'm a northerner.
So maybe could you talk about that being bolshy? And like you said, you were insisting on meeting the creatives from the agencies that were doing the work for you when you were at British Airways. So how did that come about?
It really comes through building relationships with your agency partners, whoever they are, and engendering real trust in those relationships. Then I think you can ask more of the team at the agency, feeling like you're part of one team together, and saying, you know, I want to meet the people who are creating this. I want to have those discussions with them. I want them to be presenting the work and hearing my feedback firsthand, not being put into little blocks, not being diluted in any way. So a lot of it's about being authentic as yourself and bringing your whole self into it so they can see you not just as a client but as a real person, as a human being. And a lot of things that creative bring out are really visceral feelings. I want them to see how I react to their work. I want them to understand how I am reacting in a conversation to seeing it and not having that kind of put in a document and fed back to them. So you have to build the relationships to be able to ask to be part of that creative process with an agency, and our best works come out of it.
So within the theme of Creative Equals Rise, how would you encourage maybe any creatives, either brand or agency, to be more bolshy, to rise up?
I think they need to ask to be in the meeting, step up and step into the conversation. I think if there's a very traditional setup in an agency where they wouldn't be invited to meet the client or be part of the discussion, it's not every meeting, that's not efficient, but critical ones or have meetings where we discuss the creative work together. And if they're not being invited to the table, then I'd question whether that's the right culture. If that's something they want and it's not being done in their agency, question the culture of the agency that you're in because it's not serving you. And, you know, I've learned through my career that things that don't serve you don't make you happy, and therefore you've got to make your choices and change.
Can you talk a little bit more about what is keeping CMOs up at night?
The thing that probably kept me up most at night and still does is ensuring that the CFO, who often has the power of the pen, really, really understands what marketing is about and what marketing does. I see a lot of decisions being made for the short-term financial gains. And whilst tactical marketing can do that, promote a product, does it sell, does it not sell off the back of that promotion, building brands and making them part of popular culture is something that is a much longer burn and it's a lot harder to measure. So I have always said, and I stand by, you as a CMO, you have to be the voice of the customer, but you have to speak it in the language of the CFO inside a business. And in my career, the influence the CFO has on whether your marketing budget lives or dies, withers on the vine after your great ideas, is fundamentally built on their understanding of what it is that you're going to do for the financial results of the business. So you have to be able to tell that story and you have to be able to champion marketing because that is the thing that is ultimately going to build your brand, evolve it for its future survival, or have it die.
Thank you so much for your time, Abby, today. I've loved catching up with you.
Could you introduce yourself to me and tell me about your job role?
So my name's Emily Philp. I'm the founder of Flex Events, which is the organisation that has produced Creative Equals Rise conference today.
And what are Creative Equals events all about?
So they're
first and foremost about inclusivity. They're about bringing people together to talk about very important issues in the industry around diversity, around gender pay gap, around how we can ensure that everyone is fighting for the same cause, which is about having more inclusive creative departments. And so today we've had an amazing group of female creators, but also a lot of men here as well, who are talking about the cause and ensuring that we're striving for the same goal.
Amazing, thank you. And how has it been to work with Ali on Creative Evening?
She's absolutely amazing. She's my favourite client. She's just really inspiring, very approachable, just an absolute bundle of joy. And she's pulled such an amazing group of people together, and I feel like she's the only person who could do this. She really is just an inspiration to everyone, so I really enjoy working with her.
Oh, thank you, Emily. It's been lovely to speak to you. Could you tell me what inspired you the most today and what you might be taking back to either your career or your workplace?
I think just be yourself. I did really love Mary Portis. I mean, I've read some of her stuff and seen her interview before, but I think when you've got Mary in the flesh, it's really like you get her energy and just sort of being like owning who you are and actually using that as a sort of your USP kind of thing. And I think that came across with quite a few of the other speakers. It's like, you know, don't worry about not being the right thing or not saying the right thing. Just kind of have a bit of confidence.
I've thoroughly enjoyed today. Meeting such incredible change makers to the industry is evidence of the power of collectively working together as a strategy to speeding up change. A huge thank you to Emily Phillip of Flex Events, to all the fantastic contributors, and to my incredibly talented colleague, Ursie Downs, and to the wonderful producer, Pat, who behind the scenes has been incredibly supportive and organised. If you enjoyed this podcast, it would be amazing if you could subscribe, rate, and write a review, as it makes a huge difference in it reaching others. This podcast is made possible with the support of Hub, an insight-led content agency. A huge thank you to the editors, Daniel Clark and Laura Francis.